Welcome to Trawler Talk, the official podcast of Passage Maker Magazine, the long-range cruising authority. I'm your host, Editor-in-Chief Jeff Moser. If this is your first time here, welcome, and if you're a returning listener, thanks for coming back.
Before we get started, we'd like to thank our sponsor, SiriusXM Marine. Weather can put a serious damper on what was a great day on board your boat, so having up-to-date weather and sea conditions is critical, especially for those of us who plan on traveling offshore. And while onboard radar is useful for determining the location of other vessels, it does not provide a very wide image of impending storms or their size and direction. For this very reason, having SiriusXM's satellite-derived weather onboard is essential for many cruisers. This service overlays weather information such as lightning strikes, weather radar, and marine zone forecasts directly on your multifunction displays in large format while you are navigating. So, if you want to increase your situational awareness and add to your peace of mind of knowing exactly what weather and sea conditions lie ahead, visit SiriusXM.com/marine today to get started. Now, here's our podcast. When I caught up to our next guests, Eric and Kim Paulson, they were in a harbor in El Salvador enjoying the excellent coffee and local cuisine like they had all the way down the Pacific coast of Mexico on board their 1968 Grand Banks 42 Classic Splinters. How they got there is a heck of a tale that starts 15 years ago and nearly a mile above sea level in the Rocky Mountain foothills of Colorado, where the couple housed the then very neglected 42 Classic and began her restoration. It's a tale best told by those who lived it, so without further delay, here's the Happy Cruiser with the story of their restoration and now their life on board. Hope you enjoy it. How did you first acquire your Grand Banks 42 Classic?
Well, the story goes, we had bought a small half-acre lot in Lopez Island up in the Salish Sea, and thinking it's going to be a kind of a retirement place for us. And after spending some time up there, it's undeveloped. We kind of realized that we had bought a place in the woods and really not a place on the water. We were like one lot removed from the water, and they called it a filtered water view, but the winds would have to be 100 miles an hour to actually see the water. So we really didn't think that was going to be the place for us to, you know, build and retire on. So I had a sailing background. I was the West Coast rep for Schaefer Marine for years. And Kim has sailed quite a bit too. We said, well, how about a boat? Then we could change our view of our waterfront view, you know, whenever we wanted to. So we kind of started looking around and we kind of made the decision that a trawler would be better since, you know, living on a sailboat, you're really kind of down in a cave a bit. And Kim really liked the openness and the airiness of a trawler. And I had, you know, had been aware of Grand Banks and was very impressed with the quality and the long-lived reputation that they have. So we started looking for trawlers. And we were living in San Diego at the time, and we were living, pretty much looking at trawlers on the West Coast, and our requirements were that it needed to have no rot in the hull and the engines being good, because we pretty much knew that we would be redoing the whole boat. We had kids who were about 8-9 years away from graduating high school, so we wanted to stay in Colorado, so I kind of also was looking for a project like that. So we found this boat in Santa Barbara, and did a survey, everything looked good, and we brought it to Colorado.
See, that's you're burying the lead a little bit there. So you brought a boat from Southern California to Colorado.
Right. From Colorado, yeah.
Wow. And then what were you doing? How did you have the space to work on the boat at your home in Colorado? How did that work out?
Well, we lived on 6 acres in the foothills of Colorado, and we had a 60-by-40-foot barn. And at first, we put the boat outside of the barn, thinking we would build a shelter over it. But as it became more apparent that it would be easier to have the boat in the barn, so a year after we moved the boat to Colorado, we had the boat mover come back out and move the boat into the barn, which kind of comes to one of the low points in the whole story, is that when we were doing that process, the tractor with the semi-tractor actually sunk into our septic system, and we had to get in a huge truck to get it out of the septic system and repair the septic system, and I was about ready to dig a hole and have Kim bury me in it at that point. But it got in the barn, and it was a great way to work on the boat. I had a big wood stove and another smaller propane-fired stove that I could, you know, provide heat in the wintertime so I could cure epoxy still and keep working on it.
Yeah. Kim, while he was working on the boat, what kind of things were you helping out with as far as the labor goes to getting the boat ready for the water?
Well, mostly I was working. But I would help on the weekends, and we would strip paint and sand, a lot of sanding. Thus the name of Flinders, because it reminds us that if we don't take care of her, that is what's going to happen. So it was just a lot of work. I mean, I would be overwhelmed. Eric was amazing. He just kept plugging and plugging, and he remodeled everything. But it was, you know, a team effort. But I have to say, Eric did most of it.
And she's a Woody, is that right? I believe that's correct.
Yeah, she was built in 1968.
68, yeah. So almost toward the end of the wood production there in, I guess that would probably be Hong Kong. At that point, up until the early 70s. So you're in this high, dry area in the foothills of Colorado. Take me through the project. I guess you said the low point was maybe even the boat sinking before you even get it into the sinking in the mire before you even get it into the shed. But what were some of the high points? What did you discover about the boat as you went through the restoration?
Well, I've done a lot of woodworking, and I think just building furniture and building the design that we come up with, building all that out was really fun for me. You know, we built a mm-hmm. helm seat and a settee, a purpose-built refrigeration freezers, put veneers all throughout the interior of the boat. Everything was painted white. Just, you know, redesigning and the woodworking side, I really did enjoy a lot.
Yeah. What kind of time frame did you have in mind while you were doing the restoration? Did you have a goal to get it on?
Of course, when we bought the boat, I thought it would take 4 years. Mm-hmm. And the boat mover, who had a lot of experience with boats and projects, laughed and said, well, you could at least double that. And of course, he was almost spot on.
it was over 8 years total for the restoration?
Yeah. Well, the boat was in our barn for 8 years. Kim had, you know, she was working for AIM. Mm-hmm. Kim was offered or was asked to move to San Diego to mm-hmm. Run a new acquisition. And so we negotiated with AIM to say, instead of moving our house, would you move our boat to San Diego?
Yeah.
But the boat was still probably, well, it turned out to be about a year and a half away from actually being able to be launched. So she sat on the hard at the boat mover's lot about 10 miles away from the ocean, where I continued to work on her and actually got a little help, which was really great because of the there's a good knowledge base of boats in San Diego versus Colorado
sure.
to kind of streamline and make some things happen a little faster.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you talked a lot about the hull and some of the woodwork you've done. What were the engines? I assume the engines and the transmission and the rest of the mechanical stuff that was in fairly decent shape, or was that replaced as well?
No, the running gear, the propellers, although let's say propellers had to go, they were pretty much eaten up mm-hmm. By galvanic corrosion. But the rest of the running gear was all in very good shape. The engines have had only about 2,600 hours, and they look really good. So aside from engines, hull, and the running gear, we pretty much replaced everything. We rewired her, replumbed her. I put new fuel tanks in. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And we got rid of our generator. The idea was to make this a DC boat as much as possible.
Okay.
So we have a good-sized lithium bank. We've got a good solar array on the top of the Bimini. Mm-hmm. And we've tried to limit all the bigger appliances to being DC versus AC.
Mm-hmm. Is there air conditioning on the boat? Is that DC as well, I assume?
Well, we actually do have an air conditioner, and it's a little tiny one-room air conditioner that we have. So we only have been using it when we're plugged into shore power.
Got it.
But yeah, that would be a really nice thing to do. And there are some pretty nice DC units out there now I've been reading about. So
yeah,
it might be on the list in the future of something we might want to do.
Yeah, especially with the cruising that we're going to talk about soon. So, okay, the big day comes. Describe getting splinters in the water that first time.
Well, that was getting splinters out of the barn was actually a bigger problem.
Okay, let's talk about that.
Well, we had a boat motor come out. This was in November. We had had a little bit of a snowstorm in the area about 10 days prior, and the boat motor came out on Wednesday. I looked everything over on Thursday. Friday, come up to me and said, "Eric, I need to have heavy equipment to get this boat out of the barn. I need to have a track hoe or something big I can use." And of course, this is Friday about 4 o'clock, and I don't know where you come up with a track hoe or something in an hour. And he's saying that, well, I have another boat to move in Texas that I got to get to by Tuesday. So unless you can find something that's going to be here tomorrow, I can't move your boat. Well, the house had been sold. We were closing in the house in 2 weeks, so it really wasn't an option. And we were able actually to be lent a front-end loader from a construction site that was working on a road that there was a flood in Loveland 3 years prior that wiped out the road that goes from Loveland up to Estes Park, which is a big tourist commuter highway. And these guys had a big front-end loader, never been used, that they offered to give us for free for the weekend to get the boat out of the barn and up this little hill and onto the road.
Wow.
Which was just pretty much incredible. The boat mover couldn't believe it that we could figure something out so quick.
God intervention there.
Yeah.
It sounds that way, Kim. It sounds like the boat mover was sort of, they were angling to get to Texas and we're going to leave you behind, but you proved they set it up for you. They said, you got to get this, this, and this. And you said, okay, I'll do it. And I don't know, somehow you did it.
That is the truth.
But yeah, the day the boat went in the water was quite a day. A lot of nervous apprehension. You know, the boat hadn't been wet in 11 years. And I was ground level, water level, looking at the boat getting wet. And
the lift at the boat yard was broken. The travel lift broke, so they had to crane to lift the boat, to put it onto a trailer, to then take it to the water, to put it on a lift, to get it into the water. So this boat had to creak and crack like so many times to get itself into the water.
Man, nothing's easy. Everything seems conspired against you to get this boat in the water, doesn't it? And so,
but she floated. Yeah,
she floated.
We got wet, and it was very exciting.
But Eric was very nervous because he had done the West Systems model because in Colorado it was so dry that the dribbling up in Colorado, and so he did the West Systems model on it. But you don't quite know what's going to happen when you put it in the water, because now it's steady and you're putting it into water again. So he was definitely nervous as a cat.
You had such a great foundation to work with the 42 Classic.
Eric talked me into living on the boat that wasn't finished. So somehow this was my new home too. So I was kind of nervous as well.
And Kim, you were at this point, you were still working. Is that right?
Yeah, I was still working, but now in San Diego.
Okay. This podcast is sponsored by Sirius XM Marine. Sirius XM Marine Weather is a priceless tool for planning your trips and for knowing up-to-date conditions while you're underway. So don't leave shore without it. Visit SiriusXM.com/marine today to get started. Now, back to our podcast.
Now, was it the plan for this boat was like, this is our retirement plan. We're going to sort of live on this boat and take little trips and that's going to be our thing. Was that what was always sort of envisioned or is that just what happened?
No, that is what happened. I thought this boat was going to be a summer holiday in Lopez Island and around. And then when my job transferred us to San Diego, it became full-time life on a boat, which was not the original plan, but has been amazing.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. What are the some of the first places that you ventured off to in the boat in around San Diego?
Well, there's a few harbors and places you can put the hook down right in San Diego Bay. So we would make those rounds quite often and get used to anchoring and whatnot. The Mission Bay and within San Diego Bay. Kind of a funny thing, you know, you see so many boats that never leave their slip. And there was a guy who was a boat owner on our finger who's on the end tie. It was an 85-foot symbol, a beautiful power boat that he had, you know, lovingly been taking care of. And we were talking one day and he said, so are you one of those guys that never leave the slip, you know? And that put the hackles in me, you know. I was like, well, I'm going to show you. And so he actually was like, well, I'm going to head to Catalina, which was about 11 hours away in a couple weekends. Do you guys want to go with us, this buddy boat up there? And so that was kind of our first foray out of, like, really out of the bay and going somewhere overnight. Chris Wirtz was pretty instrumental in getting us kind of going, you know, not one of those boats that, you know, lives on the slip. You know, there are quite a few people that do that.
Yeah, there's quite a few marina queens, isn't there? But it sounds like that he laid the gauntlet down and you took it up and you made the trip to Catalina. And that did that light a fire under you guys for more exploration, or what was the trip like?
Yeah, it was great. It was great. It was super cool to be on the ocean at night and just being out there and steaming along. And we did that. I don't know. We probably did 6 or 7 Catalina trips. And we did a trip down to Ensenada, which was about the same distance, about 11 hours, 12 hours away, and got some of the requirements we needed to cruise in Mexico. Our original plan still, after the boat had gotten to San Diego, was to take the boat north up to Seattle.
Okay.
But Kim started doing some research on this.
I started watching Passage Makers online education on survival in cold water and said to Eric, hey, we could go south. The water's a lot warmer and we could practice down there.
It's a tempting offer. It sounds like you took it up, right, Eric?
Yeah, so we, you know, talked about it a lot. And the more we talked about it, the more it made sense. And so we were also fortunate, again, with that same guy, Chris Wirtz. This was right during COVID. We had planned to leave 2019, right about when COVID was in full force. I think it was 2020.
2020, that's right.
And he said, oh, I'm going south. Why don't you guys come with me? So we went down on his boat to Cabo up to La Paz, flew back. And then joined them 2 more times and ended up going through the Panama Canal with them.
Wow.
Spending some time in the last, and it was an incredible trip. But on that first leg with them, we met John and Pat Raines, who had written kind of some of the best cruising books for the Southern Latin America or Central America, as well as the book that goes into Mexico.
And, oh, okay.
And they were really instrumental too in kind of getting us more and more comfortable with cruising south and whatnot. So
then what was the first big trip you took on splinters in, I guess, crossing into Mexico and on the Pacific coast there?
Well, it was going to Cabo.
We went to Ensenada once, and then we came back.
Okay.
And we got our tip. And then, you know, practice just going once down and back and spent the weekend down there. But then we got ready and left.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Now, do you go back to San Diego, or you guys have this, you're out now, you're out and you're past Mexico and you're just continuing the cruise?
Yeah, we haven't been back to San Diego on the boat since we left San Diego. So we left the boat one time in San Carlos, Mexico, up in the Sea of Cortez on the mainland side for the summer hurricane season, and then traveled back in the States, saw family and whatnot, and then also left the boat in Chiapas, Mexico, just on the border of Guatemala in Mexico. Like during hurricane season.
Yeah. So tell me about, what have you discovered cruising the Mexico Pacific coast that you guys are just enamored with and love and just can't stop thinking about and going back to?
Well, the wildlife and the people, I think. We've been able to swim with whale sharks, come right by our boat in the Agua Verde up in the Sea of Cortez. We had three blue whales that we got real close to. One actually submerged and went right underneath our boat. We could watch it going underneath. We've seen fossil orcas.
We saw blue-footed boobies. And on Isla Isabela is a really cool spot, but between Mazatlan and Puerto Vallarta, right?
Yeah.
And there's tons of frigate birds, blue-footed boobies. It's kind of like the Mexican Galapagos.
Wow. And
it also has whales, just tons of whales just surrounding the island. So that was a really, really cool spot.
Yeah.
And we were very fortunate because our kids decided to take their sailboat and come down and meet us in the Sea of Cortez. So we also got to buddy boat with our oldest daughter and her spouse and their dog all through the Sea of Cortez, which was really cool.
It's a nice family trip. You, most of the time when you're in Mexico, do you marinas? Do you spend night on the hook? Do you do both? How do you handle the traveling?
Well, we do both. Sometimes it makes sense to be in a marina, most of the time we try to be on the hook. It's just really nice to not have neighbors so close. And, you know, we're set up with water maker and we can get plenty of power. So we're not beholden to be hooked up to a shore power cord. We do both, but I think we prefer to be on the hook if possible.
We've also done a ton of inland travel from the marinas where, you know, it's hard to do that from the hook. So in the Sea of Cortez, it was mostly anchorages, which were incredible. But the mainland Mexico and El Salvador, you know, where we are now, kind of are on the marina, but it allows you the opportunity to go travel inland and leave your boat in a safe place. So we've had some really incredible inland experiences too.
Yeah, you know, I've been seeing some of your photos you post on your Instagram. So tell me about some of the places you've been to in Mexico, and then we'll talk about the place you're currently at.
We spent a week doing a Spanish immersion class in Mexico City and toured all the way around there. That's a really interesting place. We also spent a week in Oaxaca kind of doing the same thing. We've taken quite a few overnight, 3-4 day trips through Guatemala, other places in Mexico, just to kind of see the history and like the Copper Canyon was just a really incredible trip up with the train and then going up to Creel and seeing some of those areas. There's so much to see in Mexico and the people are so friendly. They just go out of their way to make you feel welcome, help you if you have problems. It does really help to speak some Spanish. Kim speaks it better than I do, but we both are doing Duolingo to try to get better and talk as much as we can to the locals. But
we also have had the, you know, luxury of doing a couple of Spanish immersions. And in fact, the woman that was our Spanish teacher, she's like a 20 something, maybe 30 year old that is from Mexico City. We had her come to Chiapas and she spent a week with us on the boat. And that was really cool.
Oh, how nice. Oh, nice. And I don't know how long you've been in El Salvador, but I watched I don't know if I'd call it treacherous, but a spirited way to get in and out of the harbor there where you were at in El Salvador. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, there's a bar entrance here.
Okay.
It's all a sandbar, but mm-hmm. and it does move some. There is an expat couple that Bill and Jean that have taken upon themselves to organize a panga, and then with a local guide and with Bill, and they will lead you in and out of through the sandbar. And it's not without its risks. There was actually a boat here about a week and a half ago that didn't get in the channel properly, got broadside, got out of the channel, and lost its keel and sank. And it was just a really awful, horrific thing. But yeah, it's a beautiful place once you're in, but it is a bit, you got to be careful getting in and out.
I think you had said, or in your post, that people will skip and be hesitant to go into El Salvador in that one place where the bar crossing is, but it's so worth it to see the country. Is that right?
Yes, it is, most definitely.
Yeah.
The people, everything about this place is just the food. There's lots of great restaurants. Mm-hmm. There's good shopping. There's a U.S. embassy here. I'm getting a new passport. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really surprising how nice it is, and yet it looks like Gilligan's Island in the estuary.
Yeah, we don't hear enough about El Salvador as a vacation spot here in the States, but it sounds like you guys have cracked a code on that. So what's next for you guys? Are you planning on sticking around El Salvador? I mean, it doesn't sound like you have an itinerary to me. It sounds like you just sort of go. And...
No, yeah, it's there's nothing written down. I mean, they all laugh and say cruisers' plans are written in sand at low tide, so things are all constantly changing. But we're planning on actually exiting here sometime early next week, depending on waves and tidal height. And the next stop for us is going to be the very northern edge of Costa Rica.
As long as the papagayos are not blowing too hard.
So there is a small marina in Nicaragua that we really want to get to, but I think we might have found a good weather window to get through the papagayos and get to Costa Rica. And kind of the tentative plan at this point is to maybe a month in Costa Rica, a month in Panama, and maybe leave the boat in Panama by the beginning of June, and then go back to the States, rejoin in October, November time frame. And then we do want to get the boat up to Alaska at some point. So there's a good, we're thinking right now that we would not do a Panama Canal crossing, and then next year start perhaps the trek going north, and then get to Alaska maybe in, 3 years or something like
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm. And, how's Splinter's holding up?
She's good. There's always a few boat projects that need to be done. We've got a little bit of deck delamination that we're kind of finishing up on. But, there's always something. She's an old wood boat, but she's doing great. I mean, mechanically, we had a little oil leak that took care of here by dropping the oil pan and putting new gaskets in. And
if you saw how these guys had to do it here, I mean, they don't have fancy equipment. So they built braces and they braced our floor, and it's three guys trying to lift an engine. I mean, it was insane, but they did it, and it worked.
There's a lot of ingenuity in these people. It's not like they just can bring a starter motor into a big machine shop and have it redone. They go back to their garage and scratch their heads and figure it out and make it work. It's pretty cool the way these things get done down here.
Mm. It sounds like you guys are really enjoying yourselves. And I wanted to just thank you for your time today. And I go out and enjoy the rest of the day there in El Salvador and the rest of the week. And best of luck on your trip to Costa Rica.
Thank you. Thanks for
thinking about us. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's our pleasure. And we've been following you guys for a while, and we're envious, but we're happy that you're doing it.
Thank you.
Once again, we'd like to thank our sponsor, SiriusXM Marine. SiriusXM satellite-derived weather on board is essential for many cruisers. This service overlays weather information such as lightning strikes, weather radar, and marine zone forecasts directly on your multifunction display in large format while you are navigating. So if you want to increase your situational awareness and enhance your peace of mind of knowing exactly what weather and sea conditions lie ahead, visit SiriusXM.com/marine today to get started. Thank you for listening to Trawler Talk, the podcast of Passagemaker Magazine, the long-range cruising authority. If you enjoyed this episode, please do us a favor and go ahead and click that 5-star rating. We would really appreciate it. And if you're not a subscriber to Passagemaker, it's easier than ever to get our magazine delivered to wherever you lay your head. Just go to passagemaker.com/subscribe. This episode of Trawler Talk features post-production from Nate Gruka at Active Interest Media. For Passagemaker Magazine, this is Editor-in-Chief Jeff Moser. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, fair winds and safe travels.